In 1992, the limits of military victory became apparent during the quincentennial celebrations of Columbus's arrival in the Western Hemisphere. 500 years ago, Columbus and his fellow conquerors had wiped out the native population of Hispaniola. This was followed during the next four centuries by the methodical destruction of Indian tribes by the United States government as it marched across the continent. By now, there was a dramatic reaction. The Indians, the Native Americans, had become a visible force since the 60s and 70s, and in 1992 were joined by other Americans to denounce the quincentennial celebrations. For the first time in all the years that the country had celebrated Columbus Day, there were nationwide protests against honoring a man who had kidnapped, enslaved, mutilated, murdered the natives who greeted his arrival with gifts and friendship. Preparations for the quincentennial began on both sides of the controversy. Official commissions, nationally and in the states, were set up long before the year of the quincentennial. This spurred action by Native Americans. In the summer of 1990, 350 Indians, representatives from all over the hemisphere, met in Quito, Ecuador, at the first intercontinental gathering of indigenous people in the Americas to mobilize against the glorification of the Columbus conquest. The following summer, in Davis, California, over 100 Native Americans gathered for a follow-up meeting to the Quito Conference. They declared October 12, 1992, International Day of Solidarity with Indigenous People, and resolved to inform the King of Spain that the replicas of Columbus's three ships, the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria, will not receive permission from the Native nations to land in the Western Hemisphere unless he apologizes for the original incursion 500 years ago. The movement grew. The largest ecumenical body in the United States, the National Council of Churches, called on Christians to refrain from celebrating the Columbus quincentennial, saying, "What represented newness of freedom, hope, and opportunity for some was the occasion for oppression, degradation, and genocide for others." The National Endowment for the Humanities funded a traveling expedition called First Encounter, which romanticized the Columbus conquest. When the exhibition opened at the Florida Museum of Natural History, Michelle Diamond, a freshman at the University of Florida, climbed aboard a replica of one of Columbus's ships with a sign reading, "Exhibit teaches racism." She said, "It's a human issue, not just a red Indian issue." She was arrested and charged with trespassing, but demonstrations continued for 16 days against the exhibit. A newspaper called Indigenous Thought began publication in early 1991 to create a link among all the counter-Columbus quincentenary activities. It carried articles by Native Americans about current struggles over land stolen by treaty. In Corpus Christi, Texas, Indians and Chicanos joined to protest the city's celebrations of the quincentennial. A woman named Angelina Mendez spoke for the Chicanos. "The Chicano Nation, in solidarity with our Indian brothers and sisters to the north, come together with them on this day to denounce the atrocity the U.S. government proposes in reenacting the arrival of the Spanish, more specifically, the arrival of Cristobal Colón to the shores of this land." The Columbus controversy brought an extraordinary burst of educational and cultural activity. A professor at the University of California at San Diego, Deborah Small, put together an exhibit of over 200 paintings on wood panels called 1492. She juxtaposed words from Columbus's diary with blown-up fragments from 16th-century engravings to dramatize the horrors that accompanied Columbus's arrival in the hemisphere. A reviewer wrote that, "It does remind us in the most vivid way of how the coming of Western-style civilization to the New World doesn't provide us with a sunny tale." When President Bush attacked Iraq in 1991, claiming that he was acting to end the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait, a group of Native Americans in Oregon distributed a biting and ironic open letter. "Dear President Bush, please send your assistance in freeing our small nation from occupation. This foreign force occupied our lands to steal our rich resources. They used biological warfare and deceit, killing thousands of elders, children, and women in the process. As they overwhelmed our land, they deposed our leaders and people of our own government, and in its place, they installed their own government systems that yet today control our daily lives in many ways. As in your own words, the occupation and overthrow of one small nation is one too many. Sincerely, an American Indian. The publication Rethinking Schools, which represented socially conscious school teachers all over the country, printed a 100-page book called Rethinking Columbus, featuring articles by Native Americans and others, a critical review of children's books on Columbus, a listing of resources for people wanting more information on Columbus, and more reading material on counterquincentenary activities. In a few months, 200,000 copies of the book were sold. A Portland, Oregon teacher named Bill Bigelow, who helped put together Rethinking Schools, took a year off from his regular job to tour the country in 1992, giving workshops to other teachers so that they could begin to tell those truths about the Columbus experience that were omitted from the traditional books and class curricula. One of Bigelow's own students wrote to the publisher, Allen and Bacon, with a critique of their history text, The American Spirit. "I'll just pick one topic to keep it simple. How about Columbus? No, you didn't lie, but saying, though they had a keen interest in the peoples of the Caribbean, Columbus and his crews were never able to live peacefully among them, makes it seem as if Columbus did no wrong. The reason for not being able to live peacefully is that he and crew took slaves and killed thousands of Indians for not bringing enough gold." Another student wrote, "It seemed to me as if the publishers had just printed up some glory story that was supposed to make us feel more patriotic about our country. They want us to look at our country as great and powerful and forever right." A student named Rebecca wrote, "Of course, the writers of the books probably think it's harmless enough. What does it matter who discovered America, really? But the thought that I have been lied to all my life about this, and who knows what else, really makes me angry." A group was formed on the West Coast called Italian Americans Against Christopher Columbus, saying, "When Italian Americans identify with native people, we are bringing ourselves, each of us, closer to possible change in the world." In Los Angeles, a high school student named Blake Lindsay went before the city council to argue against celebrating the quincentennial. She spoke to the council about the genocide of the Arawaks, but she got no official response. However, when she told her story on a talk show, a woman phoned in who said she was from Haiti. "The girl is right. We have no Indians left. At our last uprising in Haiti, people destroyed the statue of Columbus. Let's have statues for the Aborigines." There were counter-Columbus activities all over the country, unmentioned in the press or on television. In Minnesota alone, a listing of such activities for 1992 reported dozens of workshops, meetings, films, art shows. At Lincoln Center in New York City on October 12th, there was a performance of Leonard Lehrman's New World, an opera about what Columbus did to the Indians. In Baltimore, there was a multimedia show about Columbus. In Boston, and then in a national tour, the Underground Railway Theater performed The Christopher Columbus Follies to packed audiences. The protests, the dozens of new books that were appearing about Indian history, the discussions taking place all over the country, were bringing about an extraordinary transformation in the educational world. For generations, exactly the same story had been told to all American school children about Columbus, a romantic, admiring story. Now, thousands of teachers around the country were beginning to tell that story differently. This aroused anger among defenders of the old history, who derided what they called a movement for political correctness and multiculturalism. They resented the critical treatment of Western expansion and imperialism, which they considered an attack on Western civilization. Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Education, William Bennett, had called Western civilization our common culture, its highest ideas and aspirations. A much-publicized book by a philosopher named Alan Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind, expressed horror at what the social movements of the 60s had done to change the educational atmosphere of American universities. To him, Western civilization was the high point of human progress, and the United States its best representative. America tells one story, the unbroken, ineluctable progress of freedom and equality. From its first settlers and its political foundings on, there has been no dispute that freedom and equality are the essence of justice for us. In the civil rights movement, black people disputed that claim of America's standing for freedom and equality. The women's movement had disputed that claim too. And now, in 1992, Native Americans were pointing to the crimes of Western civilization against their ancestors. They were recalling the communitarian spirit of the Indians Columbus met and conquered, trying to tell the history of those millions of people who were here before Columbus, giving the lie to what a Harvard historian, Perry Miller, had called the movement of European culture into the vacant wilderness of America. As the United States entered the 90s, the political system, whether Democrats or Republicans were in power, remained in the control of those who had great wealth. The main instruments of information were also dominated by corporate wealth. The country was divided, though no mainstream political leader would speak of it, into classes of extreme wealth and extreme poverty, separated by an insecure and jeopardized middle class. Yet there was unquestionably, though largely unreported, what a worried mainstream journalist had called a permanent adversarial culture, which refused to surrender the possibility of a more equal, more humane society. If there was hope for the future of America, it lay in the promise of that refusal.